Grace to you and peace from God our Father and from the Lord Jesus Christ. Well, before there was computer-generated imagery, or CGI as the kids like to say, most of the special effects on television and in the movies was done through cinematography. Miniatures were used almost exclusively and extensively in the filming of the first Star Wars movies, which are actually episode 4, 5, and 6, but they didn't tell us that at the time. Green screens were used to create the illusion of flying for Superman, talk about superheroes, right? And E.T. And animatronics, stop motion, and costuming were all used to bring creatures to life. Computers have now replaced all that so effectively at times it can be difficult to differentiate between real life and CGI. Now, I remember seeing some of the secrets of the big screen being revealed to me when me and my family went to Universal Studios when I was a kid. And that tram tour around the lot was amazing. We saw that Western towns were actually just facades. Nothing behind them. We saw the town of Amity, and we were parked as Jaws made its way around the water there and eventually attacked our tram. And we actually experienced an earthquake as our tram was parked in some underground roadway, and everything shook, and the subway crashed and everything. One special effect that is no longer in place is the parting of the Red Sea. Well, it wasn't actually the Red Sea, it was more of a lagoon, so like think of the creature from the Black Lagoon. And when our tram got to that part of the tour, it stopped because the roadway was covered with water. Think of the causeway going to Sanibel Island. Too soon? Anyway, the tram stopped, and with the push of a button, the waters receded, and our 5-car tram was able to drive across dry-ish land and get to the other side of the lagoon. Phew! But that special effect is no longer in place on the tram tour at Universal Studios. According to the website Inside Universal, on November 16th of 2016, the lagoon was removed, and now Universal's using that space for other filming production facilities. But don't despair. If you haven't been there or you haven't seen that, and if you haven't seen movies with that whole parting of the Red Sea, there's a book that describes it quite well. And we read from it this morning from the book of Exodus. Our reading today is over 400 years past where our reading ended last week, when Joseph was sold as a slave to Potiphar, who was an officer of Pharaoh. And God used Joseph to bless Potiphar so that Joseph was promoted to Potiphar's right-hand man, so to speak, and he took care of everything that was Potiphar's except for his wife, which was contrary to his wife's preferences, so much so that when he didn't respond to her advances, she accused him of taking advantage of her. And as a result, we read that Potiphar had Joseph thrown into prison, and it was actually the prison that Pharaoh threw people into. And that's where we left Joseph last week, with him in the Pharaoh's prison, and he was making a name for himself once again and had actually endeared himself to Pharaoh's cupbearer and cake maker. What we didn't read, but what we know now, is that Joseph had been interpreting the dreams of the cupbearer and the cake maker, and when they got out of prison, when they were no longer on Pharaoh's naughty list, and he invited them back into the palace, they told Pharaoh about Joseph and his ability to interpret dreams, and Joseph again began to work his way up the social ladder and eventually found himself at the right hand of Pharaoh. And there at the right hand of Pharaoh, Joseph interpreted dreams such that Pharaoh was prepared for the famine, the 7-year famine that was going to come over the land, and Egypt was able to store up enough food so that when the famine came, they were ready and they had food in Egypt. And it was a result of that famine that Joseph's father, Jacob, sent Joseph's brothers to Egypt in search of food. Well, after Joseph recognized his brothers, and after he acknowledged that he knew who they were and they reconciled, and Pharaoh heard this heartwarming story of Joseph finally being reconciled with his brothers, he invited Joseph's brothers to go and get their father, Jacob, and bring him back to Egypt, and then Pharaoh gave them land in Egypt upon which to settle. And that is how the 12 tribes of Israel, which is what Jacob's name got changed to, ended up in Egypt. And they were there for 400 years, and over those 400 years, they were made into slaves. And the book of Exodus begins with a new king in power, and that new king, we read in the first verses of Exodus, did not know Joseph. So life had become very different for the Israelites in those 400 years, and now that new king was concerned about the number of Israelites or Hebrews who existed in Egypt, and he was afraid that if a conquering army came and tried to overthrow Egypt, that those Israelites might actually fight against him instead of for him. If they joined the forces of a conquering army, they were going to be at risk of being overthrown. And so he declared that every male-born Hebrew needed to be eliminated at birth. And so he told the two Hebrew midwives to do that. And of course, if you know the story, they didn't do that. And eventually, a Hebrew male child is born named Moses. And he ends up, through good fortune or the hand of God, being raised in Pharaoh's palace. No, I don't even know where I am in all this, because anyway, it was Moses who led the Israelites in our reading this morning out of Egypt. It was Moses. You might recognize the name if you've seen that 1956 movie, The Ten Commandments. Moses played a pretty prominent role in that. It was Moses who led the Israelites out of Egypt, and it was Moses who was there at the side of the Red Sea when Pharaoh's army began to encroach upon them. Now, if you've watched one of the movies that they've made about this or read the book, you know that Pharaoh didn't just let the Egyptians go. They weren't just able to, you know, check out at the office and say, all right, we're done. 400 years is good. We're out. No, God sent 10 increasingly oppressive plagues upon the Egyptians, culminating with the killing of the firstborn in every Egyptian household. That night, the angel of death passed over the Israelite households because they had sacrificed a lamb and put the blood of the lamb on their doorposts. That Passover continues to be celebrated in Jewish households today. It was that Passover that Jesus celebrated with his disciples on the night of his arrest. And our reading begins with Pharaoh and his officials changing their minds and regretting their decision to allow the Israelites to leave. It begins with a question, what have we done letting Israel leave our service? And the follow-up question that's not included in the text is, who's going to do the work now? Now that we've let them go. So like a character in a romantic comedy who chases after their unrequited love, Pharaoh decides he needs to chase down the Israelites. So he has his chariot made ready, but he doesn't go to the airport alone to stop the Israelites from catching that plane. He takes 600 men from his army upon their chariots with him. And as Pharaoh and his army drew near, the Israelites were rightfully afraid. Imagine, if you will, a child finally fleeing their abusive parent and then seeing their parent coming after them. At that point, the child would regret their decision and say, I should have just stayed, even though I knew the abuse would continue. So the Israelites cried out to God, and they complained to Moses. Somewhat sarcastically, they asked Moses, did you bring us out here because there weren't enough graves in Egypt for all of us? They clearly thought they would have been better off if they had stayed in Egypt rather than trying to defend themselves against Pharaoh and his elite army. But Moses tells them, for the prophets and angels often say, do not be afraid. Do not be afraid, because the Lord your God is with you. You see, they had to trust in Moses, but most importantly, they had to trust in God to protect and deliver them from certain death. You see, Yahweh had promised to deliver the Israelites from their captivity, to release them from their slavery, but they had to trust. They had to have faith that the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph would honor the promise that God had made to Moses. Stand firm and see the deliverance that the Lord will accomplish for you today, Yahweh said through Moses. Let go and let God is what they say in 12-step programs. Let go and let God. Trust God. I will be your God and you will be my people, God said to Abram and his descendants. And now it's time for the Israelites to allow God, to trust God, to be just that. During all the years of that tram tour at Universal Studios, according to the website, it started. Those tram tours started in 1973. From 1973 to 2016, that tram stopped outside that lagoon countless times every day. And I'm willing to bet that there was no one on any of those trams who ever believed that they weren't going to get to the other side. It's just not plausible that they were going to turn that tram around and have to go around the lagoon. And God is looking for that same faith, that same trust out of us. Of course, God will make a way when there is no way, when we are in God's plan. God, through Moses, is seeking that same confidence, that same trust from the Israelites and from us. You see, they have just witnessed God raining locusts down on Egypt, among other things. And yet, when they see Pharaoh and his army advancing, the Israelites freaked out. You see, that same God who sent all 10 of those plagues has told them to not be afraid. So they just had to have a little faith. Just a little faith. Stand firm and see what the Lord will do. In the same way that God had used Moses to enact the plagues, Moses stretched his hand out over the sea. And the Lord drove back the sea by a strong wind from the east. Moses put out his hand, and all night this wind blew, so that there was dry-ish land for the people to cross. Now, if you've read the creation story from the beginning of Genesis recently, you might remember that it was a wind that blew over the waters at creation that separated the waters from the land. And in the same way, in that same creative act, that wind, which in Hebrew is the same word for spirit, blew over the waters of the Red Sea, so that God's people were able to cross upon the dry land that wind created. And when they had been delivered, when they were on the other side, the water returned to its normal depth. This was certainly good news if you were an Israelite. But if you were an Egyptian, not so much. For God was clearly with the Israelites as God had promised, but perhaps most importantly, they at this point were with God. They were with God. They were in God's plan. They had stood firm in their faith. They didn't advance on Pharaoh and Pharaoh's army. They didn't try to defend themselves at the edge of the sea. They followed God's direction. And God delivered them safely to the other side. You see, the promise that God had made was that God would be their God if they would be God's people, and they were. And God delivered them, just as God had promised. But what about the Egyptians? This was definitely a no-good, terrible, horrible, very bad day for them. Why would they need to suffer? From our worldly perspective, we'll probably never fully understand God's love and God's justice. However, what we do know from the Apostle Paul's letter to the Romans in chapter 28, or chapter 8:28, is that in all things God works for good to those who love him and have been called according to his purpose. So the question shouldn't be, why weren't the Egyptians chosen, God's chosen people, but why hadn't the Egyptians chosen to have Yahweh as their God? Why hadn't the Egyptians chosen God as their God? If so, God would have been fighting for them, but most importantly, they would have been fighting for God. A comment was made to summarize our discussion of this passage, a text talk on Tuesday, and I'm going to close with it. We shouldn't pray that God would be on our team, helping us to win in a battle, to win a war, to win a sports game, to win a court decision. We shouldn't pray that God would help us get our way, that God would be on our team. Instead, we should pray that we would be on God's team, that we would be working with and fighting for God. Not asking God to join us, but we should be joining God in what God's doing in the world. It may not always make sense to us, but God has promised and God has demonstrated to be faithful, and God has demonstrated God's faithfulness as we're seeing through these texts in the Old Testament. God was faithful to the covenant that God made with Abraham and to Isaac and Joseph and to Moses. And we'll read more about that next week when God will give the gift of the Ten Commandments to Moses and the Israelites in the wilderness. And God is faithful today, delivering us from our captivity to sin and death, delivering us through the waters of holy baptism into the promise of everlasting life. So have a little faith. Stand firm. Do not be afraid. And see the deliverance that the Lord will accomplish for you today. Amen.